This week's guest is bass player, entrepreneur, and social media specialist Damien Keys. Damien has worked in the music industry his whole life. He was signed at 18, has co-founded music universities all across Europe, and has now built a very successful online community of over 200,000 artists and musicians, who of which he helps get their music heard. Okay, so first question, I ask everybody this because I love hearing people's kind of like origin stories and where everything started. So how did you get into music and why bass? I know you've played probably like over 2,000 shows around the world. Where did that start and what was the starting point for all that?
So I was actually really, as a kid, I had no musical talent whatsoever at all. In fact, I wasn't a bad kid. I was just a bit sort of disruptive. I failed. So I did my GCSEs. I failed all of them, literally all of them. And then I had to resit the entire year. So whilst all of my friends either went off to college or they went off to do A-levels, I had to stay back. So I was like the oldest one then in the whole class. And so my mum made me resit my whole GCSEs, but so I resat the entire year, and then I got one, at which point I was like, okay, so I'm not going to be a doctor probably. And at which point my friend, a couple of years before, I was like not allowed to take music because they were like, look, he's not good at school, so let's not make him do music, let's make him have extra, like I had to do extra sort of history and stuff like that to try and catch up. A friend of mine had a guitar when we were at school, and I went with him for his like birthday. He bought an electric guitar. He always had like a classical guitar, and he was like, I really want to play electric guitar because it's cool. So I went with him with his parents to buy this electric guitar, and I remember being like, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen in my entire life. I didn't really listen to much music. I just thought it was really cool. And then we were just chatting, and he went, hey, we should start a band. And I was like, yeah, that's a great idea. And I was like, yeah, so should I get a guitar? And he was like, no, I'm the guitarist. So I was like, oh. So I was like, well, what do I do? And he went, you can play bass. And I was like, great. What's a bass? And he was like, it's kind of like a guitar. It's just a bit bigger. And I was like, brilliant. So I kind of went home and I was like, mum, when it comes to my birthday, can I have like a bass? And my dad was mortified. My dad used to do security for pop stars and stuff. So he was like, oh, you don't want to be the bass player, son. You want to be the guitarist. Mm. And I was like, oh, no, John's the guitarist. I have to be the bass player. And he looked at me like, oh, you got to be the bass player. And I was like, no, it's going to be great. I'll be the bass player. So in the end, it got to my birthday. We went and bought this bass, which I've never seen one since. It was called a Ninja. It was like this silver Ninja. I loved it. It was like just a plank. It was awful, but I loved it. And it was the only thing in my life that I just fell in love with straight away. I was one of those kids that just bounced around. I'll have a go at this. I don't like that. I'll have a go at this. But I just sat for hours and hours with my parents just shouting at me, being like, please play something else. And I was like, I can't. I don't know anything else. I know Another One Bites the Dust. It's pretty much all I can
Classic.
Play. So I'll play it. I'll play it for 6 hours a day. and that was it. And so I just did it and fell in love. But the good thing with being a bass player that no one tells you when you start, the good thing is you can pretty much join a band within the first week, because to be able to kind of get by, you can do that pretty quick, and everybody needs a bass player. So as long as you've got a bass and an amp, you're in. That's it. That's the prerequisite for being a bass player. Is, have you got a bass? I do. They don't ask whether you can play. They don't ask what music you like. They don't decide whether they like you. They just go, we need a bass player. You'll do. And so I was like, you know, I did this band with my mate. We found a drummer and we were just messing around. And then loads of people were like, oh, can you play bass for my band? And in my head, I was like, I haven't really learned how to play, but I'll give it a go. And of course, that was the best bit. So, you know, started playing. But because I failed my GCSEs twice, I basically then decided I was going to do a performing arts course, because I said to my mum, I've got this idea. I'm going to be a rock star. It's going to be great. Mm-hmm. She, at this point, had probably given up and just gone, you do you, mate. So I went and did a performing arts course. And then I was in a band that got signed, and just playing bass. And that band got signed to a singles deal. And then from there, we got signed to Parlophone Records, which at the time was a major. So we got signed, made a record. And I was like, that's it. I'm sorted. I'm going to be a rock star. I've heard the stories. From this point on, I'm practically going to be in Coldplay. And then what no one tells you is that lots of people get signed and some people get through and most people don't. And they don't tell you why. And so we got shelved. The head of the label left. We got shelved. And then after that, we just got dropped off the label. And I remember thinking, okay, well, what happens next? You know, how do we get the next record deal? And the manager just went, that's it. You're done. It's finished. Like, no one's going to touch you with a barge pole. And I said, well, what do I do now? And he went, I don't know, get a job. So I was like, oh, that was a short-lived career as a bass player. I was like 18 at this point. I was like, that's a short-lived career as a bass player. And I was in Swansea in South Wales, which is not exactly a hub for opportunity. And so I was like, I need to get out. So I was like, London. So I went on a trip to London, got scared because it's huge. And then I was like, London's a bit scary at the time. So I was like, maybe I'll think about going to London. And then a guy that I met said, look, there's this college that's opening up in Guildford, which is Surrey, which is kind of near London, but it's not London. It's not as scary. And I was like, that makes sense. I'll go to music college. I'll learn how to read music, which seemed like a good idea at the time. And I never actually did that. And I'll meet people and I'll be near London and I can get gigs and get out of Swansea. And that's how it started. I just sort of left and met a bunch of great people. They asked me to stay on at that music college after a couple of months. And I, as a bass teacher, and I was there for 3 years and then, or maybe 4 years. And then we felt like it was getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And so myself and one of the other guys who worked there were like, we should just go and build our own. Like we could do that. Seemed like a really simple thing to do at the time. You know, when you just kind of go, hey, we should do something. So we did. We just left and we thought, let's go and build something like another place. And we moved to Brighton, which was about an hour down the road. And we started in my living room with a computer that we got from a charity, basically organization that gave us this old school computer. We hired one person who sat in my living room whilst we were trying to figure out how to build this thing. And yeah, it just grew out of control. And, you know, we always said we keep it really small. We said first year it'll be 100 students. Second year, the college will be 200 students. And the third year, the college will be 300 students. Now it's got like 7,000 students. So it just got bigger and bigger and bigger. But yeah, it was always, and that was the thing. I think as much as I love, you know, I loved playing bass and I loved gigging, I think it wasn't as me as education was. And I think a lot of people say, well, you know, why don't you go and be a bass player? Or why don't you go and get a record deal? Or why don't you go and do the thing? And I'm like, well, what happens if that isn't you? Like, what happens if you're looking at saying, I don't want to do those things? I always struggled with, you know, being away on tour for a couple of weeks. And I'm like, oh, a lot of tour life was just something that for me, it just wasn't really me. So I'd be like, there's a lot of waiting around. There's a lot of kind of hanging around with the same people all day, every day, week in, week out. And after about a week, you're thinking, I could stick this fork in your head right now. and so, you know, I was just like, it wasn't really for me. Yeah, I say it wasn't really for me. I did plenty of it, but it wasn't my passion. Whereas what I loved was sitting down with a musician or an artist and figuring problems and being like, how are we going to get you a manager? Or how are we going to put this music out? Or how are we going to figure out a problem? And I was like, oh, I love that bit. That was the bit. And so that's kind of how it started, really. And that's how education started. And I found that I just loved it so much that every day I'd kind of wake up and enjoy the day.
Yeah, that's crazy that it all started from an idea with your friends. You were basically just like, let's make us, like, the simplicity of let's do it, and then you ended up, obviously that clearly took time. And
yeah,
I appreciate that you say as well that you found that the musician lifestyle wasn't really for you, because a lot of people put the two and two together, they're like, oh, you enjoy playing music, you are a bassist, that must mean that you really enjoy the musician lifestyle, which is something I really relate to, because I can't, although I've never toured, me knowing the type of personality I have, I really struggle to imagine myself thriving in that kind of environment. And although I love playing bass and it's all that I want to do, I really struggle to see myself enjoying being on tour and, like you said, wanting to stick a fork through people. So I really appreciate that perspective.
Do you know, especially as a bass player, because I think when you're a bass player, more than anything else, it's not like you're not an integral part, but at the same point, it's not quite the same thing as being the front person, the singer, the songwriter, probably the guitarist. And as a bass player, you have this sort of probably more of an up and down career than most, because, you know, there's been times in my life where I literally have played a stadium and played a birthday party on the same day. I played St. James's Park, and I'm like, I remember driving away from St. James's Park, and then we drove and I got dropped off. You know, we went somewhere, and all of a sudden I'm playing a birthday party to like 40 people.
Wow.
And the guys in the band are like, you just drove from St. James's Park. And I was like, it was amazing. I was talking about it. And all of a sudden, and I'm playing, you know, Mr. Brightside at a birthday party.
Gosh.
And I'm like, this is a weird, but that's the life of a bass player, you know. All of a sudden you're just like, oh, I was just playing to 40,000 people, now I'm playing to 40 people. It's just ups and downs of being a musician. And it's different if you're a, you know, an artist songwriter, then, you know, it's a very different thing. But when you're a bass player and you're like, well, I get paid to play bass, and so, you know, some people have the privilege of being able to say yes or no to things. But when you're a bass player and you go, well, that's kind of my gig. And so if I'm not gigging, I need a gig. I need the money. And so, yeah, you have this crazy ups and downs where, you know, you're on a great tour, but then that tour comes to an end. And then you're like, oh, I need another tour. And then the next tour comes up and you go, oh, I guess I'll take that tour. And juggling, it's weird.
Yeah, no, I mean, this, and because I've never experienced it as well, I feel like I already know that it's not for me. I will at some point love to experience that, but I probably will find that I'm more like you, enjoying kind of doing other sides of it and not being kind of very much in that lifestyle. I'm going to backtrack a little bit there. It's really interesting. I speak to a lot of people on this podcast that have never really placed a focus on theory and that side of understanding of things, or have only done that really later on down the line. What was your experience with that? I know you said you went, was it only at 18 that you then started diving into the whole theory stuff? What was your relationship with it?
Yes, I was really, you know, I wasn't really self-taught in the way that the first proper band that I ever joined, the guitarist had to kind of come around like twice a week and show me how to play, because I didn't really know how to play. I was like 15 at the time.
Yeah.
He was really nice. He'd come around and be like, look, we need a bass player. We've been looking for ages. You're a bass player. I'll teach you. So he kind of came around and gave me some ideas, and that helped. And then after that, I went to do a performing arts course. And it was like, every day would be like, I'd be learning about lighting or dancing or something else. But there was like 1 hour a week where I get a bass lesson with this guy. And that was everything, was that was my highlight of the entire week. And he was amazing, this bass player. And then from there, when I went to ACM, which was a college in Guildford, there was a guy called Paul who was like, he was like my bass mentor, because as soon as I saw him play, I'd seen loads of bass players, but as soon as I saw him play, I was like, oh wow, his sound, his feel, it's like this guy, you know, I've heard loads and loads of great bass players, but this guy's sound and groove was huge, and I was like, that, I want to be able to play like that. And so as much as I was self-taught, you know, in the same ways everyone else was, you know, I used to do another thing, which was when I was 17, I passed my driving test when I was 17. My dad was a driving instructor, so I passed quite early on. Helpful.
Yeah.
And then I used to drive from Swansea to London, which was probably like, I don't know, 250 miles,
jeez,
I think it was, so that I could drive for a bass lesson, because there was a place in London called Bass Tech. And there was like, I was like, I want those guys to teach me to play bass. And at that point, I met this guy called Rob Burns. And this guy was like a theory monster. And so in my head, I was just like, I want to play. I want to achieve. I want to go and do gigs and stuff. And he used to sit down and, you know, he'd start talking about theory. And I was like, you're talking to someone who's, you know, when it came to academic stuff and education, I was like,
yeah,
I'm really bad at this stuff. And I'd go home with loads of notes, and I'd get home after a 4-hour drive, and I'd be like, what does this mean? It looks like it's Chinese. I don't really understand any of it. And so, but it was only when I was sort of 19, when I went to music college, that I started to understand the relationship between theory and applied theory, because theory for the sake of theory, great, but the actual application of, okay, but if you're songwriting, or if you're on a gig, I don't know if you've ever done this, but you know when people offer you gigs, everyone says you should just say yes to everything. Yeah. It's one of those pieces of advice that teachers say to you, and it's the worst piece of advice I think I've ever had, because one day someone said, I really need a bass player to do a sight reading gig, and my reading is pretty terrible. And I was like, say yes to everything. And then all of a sudden I was like, I'm sure I can do it. And then I opened the book and I was like, nope.
No.
So luckily there was some sort of half chart, half reading. And I'm like, I'm just going to have to just get through it. And it was just the worst experience of my life, just panicking, sweating, because I wasn't a reader. But it was those moments where you start realizing how it all kind of comes together between the kind of theoretical side, you know, whether it's reading, whether it's theory, whether it's songwriting, whether it's oral perception, you know, listening, all of this stuff kind of fits together and pieces together so that it helps you turn up to a gig and understand what's going on at any moment. When people start just turning up and throwing numbers at you, and at first you're like, is that a telephone number? What's going on? What are you talking about? And then you start realizing how it pieces together. So I think, you know, it's one of those things that, is it the most important thing in the world? No, I'd say groove and feel and sound and people skills and being able to do a gig and turning up on time and all those things. But the more strings to your bow, the easier it is to get work, especially with the next couple of years that we go into, whatever this thing is of cost of living / recession. You know, this is the time where, you know, I have a management company, which we hire about 120 musicians. And, you know, when the gigs start to kind of shrink because people don't have as much money, they're not pushing people, they're not hiring as many musicians, or they're not putting on as many gigs, only the strong survive. And so then it's like, okay, so who's the most hireable? And the people who are the most easy to use, the most organized, they've got their shit together, they are, you know, they drive, they have good gear, they don't let you down. And then you start looking at who can just turn up and just be thrown in the deep end and figure it out.
Yeah, no, you're so right. And the applied theory as well, that being the stuff that you need to know, is very true. I filmed an episode with Derek Bennett, also an incredible bass player. And we were having this discussion and I was trying to get it out of him. I asked him, what do you think is the best way to learn bass? And he was trying to be all like politically correct and not offend anyone. But I was straight up like, look, I think the best way to learn bass is you do your experimenting in the beginning. You know nothing about theory. You just play the bass. You work on your technique and your feel. That's it. And then you do the theory later. And that is, like you said, the applied theory, where everything then starts to click. And then you're not then trapped in your boxes of, oh, I need to use this scale for this and everything like that. It's more reliant on ear. So you saying applied theory makes a lot more sense. And I think I'd say that to people as well, that don't force yourself, because you're so right. It is like being in school again and having to sit down and like learn all this stuff that you don't want to learn. But then learning the applied theory, the things that are useful in gigs, like the Nashville number system, shouting out the numbers, like that's the stuff that's going to get you places. It might not always be fun to practice, but no, I completely agree with your take on that.
It makes a huge difference. What bass do you play at the moment?
I have a bike bass. Have you heard of bike guitars before? Tone is absolutely incredible. It's a PJ bass, but I've reversed the, I think it's the P. Also, I'm not great with all the technical stuff, but I don't know why it sounds as great as it does. I think it's the J pickup. I'm obsessed with the sound that I get. Oh, it's here, actually. I shall show you.
Oh, that's lovely.
Yeah, it's...
That beautiful colour as well.
It's custom. It's like, I kind of wanted one to stand out, because when he reached out to me about giving me this bass, it was the time that I decided to do this full time. So I was like, I want something to represent this new beginning where I'm going for it, and it's loud, and it's... So yeah, this is what I play most of the time now, but I also have my Fender Player Precision.
Nice big neck too. Yeah, lovely.
Which I play as well. But now that I have the other one with all the other options on it, I can't really play this that much now, because I see the difference in the tone and stuff.
love that.
Yeah, but I have quite a few. I have a Sire one as well, but I have not played this one for a while. Five string. I probably should play that more.
Oh, look at the neck on that.
I do love this one. Yeah. I definitely do need... What is it that you play? What's your go-to?
My main bass is... I've got a 1977 Precision. That's always been my main bass. I've got so many basses. Yeah. I mean, the funny thing is this is great because I get to talk... I never get to talk bass. Like the other day, someone was like, oh, I didn't know you played bass. And I was like, that feels... For me, it feels weird when, like... Because my life's always been around predominantly around bass. And now people think of me as the social media guy. And I'm like, I guess, but I'm kind of a bass player. But, I mean, I've got... A lot of my basses are in the UK. So I've got my main bass is a 77P bass. And I've got my backup when I'm on tour is a 76. That's a black P bass. I've got 76 white P bass. Then the basses I have here, only because I got them whilst I was here in Nashville. I've got about three jazzes.
I do love a jazz bass.
Yeah, I like this one because it's got quite the neck is quite a small neck, so I get if I've got a big fat neck, then I'm probably going to go P bass. Whereas this is nice and thin. It's just old. It's a bit battered. I like a good battered bass. I've got a couple of Music Man. I've got a five string Music Man over here, which. Only because this is a weird thing. I bought this off a man in a trailer.
Oh.
I saw it and he was like, do you want to buy my bass? And I was just like, no. And he was like, oh, it's just, I need some money for something. And he sold it to me for basically about half price of what it was. Cause he was like, I don't want it anymore. Do you want it? And I was like, well, I guess. So I've got a white version of these. I used to have a black one. I've got two JD Supernatural. I've got a blue one and a pink one with lights, which I love because I used to love Mark King. When I was growing up, my favorite bass players, this is so weird, was Mark King. I was obsessed with Mark King. So I'd spend my entire life just learning, you know, slap bass playing, Mark King riffs. I'm just like obsessed by it. And then the other thing I loved was, weirdly enough, the bass player from the Stranglers is a guy called JJ Burnell. And he was the first bass player I ever saw live, and they have this song called Hanging Around, and it's got some keyboards, then there's some hi-hat comes in, and then this P bass, this is the reason why I play a P bass, this P bass comes in, with he just plays like G to A, doo-doo, and it like hits you in the chest, and I was like, what is that? It's huge. And I was like, I need that bass, that's the bass. So I have basically the same black P bass. So I've got Mark King's versions of the JD. What else have I got? I used to have, so get this, I used to have a six string Status. So one time I got this, the guy who makes Status, a guy called Rob Green, they're going to make me a bass. And I was like, this sounds great. And so I was like, I obviously need a six string because I need more strings. Why wouldn't I need more strings? And just made me this, what was it, an ironing board. I remember getting it and being like, do I need the extra string?
But it was
huge. And so I had this like massive big Status bass, which I remember turning up to my first gig with it, with a six string, and they all looked at me like, don't do that. Please don't do that. What else have I got? I've got a Gibson Thunderbird just because it looks cool. It's the worst thing to play. I've got a Rickenbacker, 73 Rickenbacker. Have you ever played a Rickenbacker?
No, I haven't.
It's the hardest guitar to play in the world.
Is it?
Yeah, because like playing with fingers is really difficult. So you end up playing with a pick because it sounds really good. It's got like two stereo inputs, so you can plug two amps in at the same time.
Jeez.
But with most basses, obviously this part of the body is like nice and round, so you can kind of rest your hand on it. Or if you're coming up and down, the thing with a Rickenbacker is it's like square. So if you ever play with a pick, after about 5 minutes, you just start taking all the skin off your arm.
I think
if you play a Rickenbacker, you need to be a Rickenbacker player, which I'm definitely not. So
I want to Google people that play it now.
Yeah, Rickenbacker, they look so cool. They look great.
You know what? I don't think I've ever actually seen you play. Are there videos of you playing online?
Yeah, there are. Yeah, there's I people send me one every so often. There's one in particular. I was working with a. When I was in Brighton, like an education thing, and they were like, oh, we need some bass videos. So I was like, okay. So I think there's a few there, but I don't play much anymore. I mean, considering how obsessed I was for, you know, for years and how much I taught bass both at ACM and BIM, I was like absolutely obsessed with it. And then I think there was a moment, for me where I was literally playing bass. I was on tour, actually. I was in Red Square in Russia, in Moscow. And I remember thinking to myself, I don't want to be here anymore. I want to go home. And I went home and I stopped playing for like 3 years. And then, yeah, it was like weird because I was just playing all the time. And then my best mate at the time, who was also a bass player, this was like years later, I had my P bass. That's all I had. No gear. And he was like, I need you to cover a gig for me. And I was like, I don't play anymore. And he was like, no, but I'm really struggling. I need you to do this gig. And I was like, the way he put it, I was like, I can't say no because he's going to be in the shit. So I was like,
yeah.
I was like, fine. And the gig was like that day. So I was like, I'm sure I'll figure it out. So I drove to the gig. I was like, I haven't got an amp. Like, I don't have an amp.
Yeah.
But the college had an amp. So I was like, I'll just take one of the amps. So I had this, like, I turned up to do effectively what was semi-funk gig. And I had like a P bass with my AD, I think I had an Ampeg at the time, an Ampeg SVT. And I was like, this is the most unfunky setup in the history of ever. And I did the gig and I was like, I was really grumpy about it. I was like, I just have to drive for 2 hours to go and play bass again. I don't want to play bass again. And I turned up and I played the gig. And as soon as the drummer started counting in and started playing the song, I was like, this is the greatest thing ever.
Oh.
I was like, I want to play again. And so I have these, like, the relationship I have with bass is I don't play for a while. And then I'm like, I want to play bass again. And weirdly enough, being in Nashville, I do doing lots of social media for artists. Like, a couple of the artists have been like, would you be up for playing some bass?
Mm.
And for the first time in a long time, I've been like, yeah, okay, I'll play some bass again. That'll be fun. So I've started to kind of just get back into little practicing routines and start playing and
yeah,
bit of fun, you know.
Yeah, no, 3 years actually is quite a long time, but that's really cool that, like, the minute you finally said yes to something. Also, saying yes to things is so hard, so difficult. Anyway, that's something else. I'm quite an anxious person, so saying yes to new things and doing things that, like, I'm also very introverted, so doing things that make me a little bit uncomfortable is, like, the hardest task ever. But like you said, you feel so great for it afterwards.
Yeah, I think that's the bit, isn't it? You want to keep the passion alive. I think that's the thing. You know, for me, when I'm doing YouTube, it's obviously a lot of social media, but a lot of people get caught up. I mean, I would say as a musician and a creative and as an artist in general, I would say the biggest problem that most people have is overthinking. Mm-hmm. I'd say that as a creative, you know, and your brain is always going to tell you why something's not going to work, why you shouldn't be doing something. And it's like the little fear of, like, if I stick my head out of the cave, am I going to get eaten by a dinosaur kind of fear? And, you know, sometimes I'm sure there is that the dangers, but on the whole, going against that, it's like the yes theory thing, isn't it? Mm. But like going against it and then just thinking, was I worried about that? That was great fun. I mean, sometimes I'm sure it can go wrong, but as long as you're within your capabilities, you know, sometimes you're just in a place where you're like, I should have said yes to more things.
Yeah, and it's funny because a lot of those fears are quite irrational, and I know it when they are too, and I'm sure other people know it too, but even still, working through the fear and doing it anyway, as cringe as that phrase might be, is something that you need to do and is so rewarding after.
When you're, like, you know, when you're playing at the moment, what's your sort of practice routine?
I can't say that I have a specific practice routine. The way it started for me, I've not been playing for crazy long. I started playing in lockdown, and that was just because...
Oh, did you?
Yeah, I started playing guitar when I was 13, and then when lockdown hit, I got back into it again. There was a few years period where I didn't pick up the guitar. But when COVID hit, I had nothing to do with my time, so I was like, let's play the guitar again. So I was doing these guitar covers, and I was like, I want to make this more interesting. How could I make this more interesting? I was like, I know, I'll buy a bass. It's got less strings. Surely that makes it easy. win-win, make my covers more interesting, cool. And then the minute I brought it, and I brought a really cheap one to start with, because I know what I'm like, sometimes I don't stick to things. But even that bass, when I first got it and was first learning my songs, I think Charlie Puth Attention was the first line that I learned. Oh, which is
what a riff.
Yeah, I know. And then literally learning that and like getting it down, I think I picked it up quite quickly, considering the hardest thing for me was changing up my technique, because I was used to guitar. So I was like trying to strum the bass, which obviously you have to adapt to a whole different technique. That was the thing that took me the longest. But when I got that down, or kind of as down as I could being a beginner, I fell in love and just didn't stop. And that's kind of what I still do now. I just, when I hear a song that I like, all that I'm listening to really is the bass, and I go home and I'm like, I want to learn that. I'll do it by ear sometimes, and then sometimes by tab if I'm not feeling to do the ear stuff. And then I'll try and apply the theory and understand what's going on underneath the song with that. But I can't say I sit down at 6 p.m. every evening and run through kind of like my modes and my pentatonics and all of that. I can't say that's what I do. It's more just I play rather than practice, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's great. Love it.
Yeah. What about you? Was it more practice, or would you say you just played?
I think I definitely went through stages. I mean, I definitely went through the stage where, I mean, when I was a kid, I wanted to be like Yngwie Malmsteen of the bass. So all my favorite bass players were all the kind of crazy. I wanted to be like Billy Sheehan. I wanted to play like Mark King. I was like, I want to be able to play two-handed tapping. It was at a time as well where, you know, I was a really, really uncool kid as well. So it was like, whilst everyone was, you know, obviously trying to be in whatever the coolest band was, I was like, no, I'm going to see how many notes I can fit into anything I do. And so then I think, it's so easy to take it too far. You start going, like you said, you start going down into modes, and then all of a sudden you're like, there's modes of modes. And then I'm in like Phrygian dominant, and you're like, you're a bass player. What are you doing? but yeah, I just used to make sure that I was, I think one thing I was very lucky is I've always had, when I was playing, I always had so many gigs that I always had to learn loads and loads of songs. And I think you get used to, the more songs you're learning, it kind of does take you away a little bit from technique for the sake of technique. And because you're learning songs. But the other thing then is I was teaching bass for several years. And so whether I was teaching, styles, or if I teach some technique, for example, then I'd be trying to figure out the right style or the right technique for that player or for that technique. And so my routine was usually dictated by either the songs that I needed to learn, or the techniques that I need to learn, or the styles that I need to learn, which was very helpful when you teach at a music school, because you don't have, it's kind of dictated by the week, you know. You'd be like, turn the page and go, oh, reggae. And I would say from a bass player, I'm just not very good at it. You know, there's certain styles and techniques where I just look at it and go, God, that's, you know, to really be authentic at something is hard, you know. And so when you teach a styles course, and, you know, I was also the kid as well that when I was, now it's Spotify, but at the time I'd go and buy any jazz CDs because I really wanted to learn how to play jazz. And then I'd get to like halfway through track two and I'd be like, this is boring, I want to play Metallica. And so then I'd put on something.
Exactly how I feel.
Yeah, and I'd be like, I really need to learn this Stanley Clarke thing. And I'd be like, oh, God, give me some Megadeth. So, yeah, I feel like I was always dictated to by whatever I was doing at the time.
Yeah, no, same with me. It's whatever music I like listening to, I practice. It was the same with me with jazz. I felt this kind of like intense pressure to practice jazz and like jazz, because that's what everybody screams about. It's like the basis of things, basis. But I was never interested in it, so I just never have. Maybe at some point I will. But going back to the whole social media stuff, social media can be a great thing for musicians to market themselves on, which is what a lot of your content surrounds, but it can also be a very negative place, full of comparison and judgment. What would you say to people that struggle with that side of things, and have you ever struggled with that side, the negative sides of social media?
I mean, I struggle with it every day, and I think it's really interesting, is, you know, it's funny you say about being an introvert. And you probably have a similar thing to this, but, you know, I'm very introverted a lot of the time. And so, you know, I'm in Nashville, there's a lot of musicians. So, you know, on a kind of regular basis, someone will come up and just be like, oh, dude, I watch your videos, which is an amazing, lovely thing. I love it. And it's so nice to have people who want to say hello and appreciate it. But I think I can see in their faces, like, I didn't expect you to be like this. I thought, I don't know if they expect me to start shouting at them about their social media or something, but I'm very grateful, but I'm just not, you know, I'm terrible at networking. If there's a networking event, I'll be in the corner, sat down with a Coke, you know, and if someone wants to come and chat, great, but I'm never going to be the guy walking up to someone being like, hey, how you doing? I just can't do it. Yeah. It's awful. I'm cringe about that. And so when it comes to social media, the same anxieties as everybody else. I think a skill I have is, as my wife says to me all the time, I'm very practical. So I'm able to, from a practical point of view, I'm able to detach some of the emotions, but I still have all of the same anxieties. Like anxiety wise, you know, if it gets to the point where I'm like, oh, I've got to make a YouTube video and I haven't thought about what I'm going to do and I've only got a certain amount of time, and, you know, I'm just as worried as, you know, walking on stage playing bass, easy. Walking on stage and playing bass and I don't know what's about to happen, horrible, like terrified, because now I'm worrying and now I'm nervous and I don't like getting nervous. But at the same point, if I haven't learned something properly or someone's going to throw something at me, I'm like, oh, I'm worrying. Social media has this ability to be able to bring you up and throw you to the ground at the same time. And let's face it, you know, social media is not there. It wasn't built as a promotional tool, but it just happens to be the best thing for us to be able to use to get the name out. And so, you know, what we have to do is we have to protect ourselves from ourselves, from our own overthinking, from our own anxiety. And, you know, let's face it, you know, TikTok is one of those things that, I was in a label meeting the other day and someone said, I think one of the states in America had just basically banned TikTok. And they said, yeah, what happens if, you know, what happens if America banned TikTok, or what happens if TikTok goes away? And I was like, we throw a massive party. It's going to be great. And I think there's this thing because, like, you know, Gary Vee is like, you know, it's amazing. And I'm like, well, you know, it has the ability for some of it to be amazing, but it's also horrific at the same time. You know, it's a mixture. And we're trying to balance this amazing and bad. It's like the outcome, if you do something well, can be amazing. Like, you know, your videos pop up and I'm just like, I watch them because I'm like, this is great. That's an amazing thing that I get to find someone who I understand and connect with because of bass playing that wouldn't have happened 20 years ago. It would be like, how are you possibly going to find someone who's in Nashville to watch you play bass? Whereas those things happen there. It's great. But the bad point is all of the negatives, which is what happens when it doesn't work? What happens when the numbers aren't working? And because we live in this world where numbers are everything. And if you go and get a video that hits 10,000 or 100,000 views and you just go, I've done it. This is amazing. I've cracked it. And the next day you get 200 views and you're like, what did I take it personally? TikTok, what did I do?
TikTok is the worst for that. And TikTok is my least favorite platform, because you could get, no joke, 2.5 million or something crazy on a video, get loads of followers, even have like a great following with loads of numbers, but your videos will still tank. And
yeah,
it's frustrating.
And do you know what's really bad about it is when it's just yourself, you know, you beat yourself up and you're trying to figure out the numbers. I have to sit in these label meetings. And you'll do that and you'll get like a million views. And the next day you'll get 10,000. And instead of going, well done for the million, they just go, what happened?
Yeah.
And you're like, I don't know. Like, surely we should be celebrating the million, not the downfall of the... But that's just TikTok. Do you know what's even worse for me is with YouTube, when you put YouTube videos out on YouTube Studio, it ranks your last 10 videos.
Yeah, it does.
It's worse. So what happens is you make a video... You do the whole thing. You think, I think this is really good. You get your thumbnail, you get your title, you put it out. 30 minutes later, it just goes, that wasn't very good, was it? That was shit. I was like, that's 10 out of 10. That's the worst video you've put out in the last 3 months. And you're like, that's brutal. It's so brutal. So the way we have to, you know, the joking aside, the way we have to do this is we have to have a certain element of detachment and routine, which is very difficult when you're making something that isn't, You know, this isn't me saying I'm making something. You're saying this is me. This is literally my personality, my knowledge, everything about it. So it's very hard to detach it. But what we do need to do is we have to kind of think of building this as a library, not thinking of this as one piece, but thinking of this as I'm building, you know, as an artist would make lots of songs, a social media content creator is building lots of content where some of them are going to do really well, some of them aren't. We take the rough with the smooth in the same way. It's the same thing as, you know, playing a stadium and then playing a birthday party and just saying, you know, it's just a body of work, you know. And when people go, God, you played these gigs. And I'm like, I played a lot more bad gigs than good gigs. Trust me. Like I've done my fair share of average gigs. It just so happens that the CV moments are kind of good. You know, standing on stage and playing to 150,000 people is something that you can wax lyrical about for the next 30, 40 years of your life. You're not going to wax lyrical about playing to, you know, a bar of three people and a dog you know, that no one bought tickets for. It's just, you know, but it's the opportunities and the experiences that you're building. And so when it comes to social media, we have to think of this as a routine. The more routine, the less anxiety and mental health issues, because we're dealing with, you know, like when we go and shoot with an artist, we'll shoot later with an artist. And I'm like, I want to get 30 pieces of content, because if I wrap the entire day around one piece of content, then that's a horrible feeling if that doesn't work. Whereas if we can make 30 pieces of content and I'm like, I've got the next 2 weeks sorted and this is just another one. And so the way I think of it is, you know, I am not a fighter in any way, but I like watching like UFC and boxing. And the way I think of it is when I watch a boxer, they go into a fight and their mindset is, I'm going to throw 300 punches in one round and I might be here for 12 rounds. And if I win that fight, or even if I don't, there's another 15, 20 fights after that. So one punch is a tiny fraction of my career. And we have to think about the same thing with social media. If we're going into a boxing match and go, I've got one punch, that's all I've got, so let's hope I win, you're going to fail. Whereas if you think of it as like, look, I'm just throwing a jab, that's all I've got to do. And if I can do that 300 times and I can do that 12 times, you know, three minute rounds, I can win. And if I can do that again and again and again, one piece of social media is just one jab. And if I can do that 100, 200, 500 times, one of those might do some real damage and many of them might not, but that's okay because I'm playing the numbers game, and that's a numbers game we can win. If we're playing the numbers game of going viral, how many followers have I got? How many people have gone across to Spotify? Now I'm like, now you're playing a numbers game that you can never win, because tomorrow's a new game, a new day. So if you're playing that game, then Wednesday you're going to have a bad day. And Thursday you're going to have a great day. And now it's a roller coaster. And this is anxiety and anxiousness that you don't want to be on. Whereas if we're thinking, it's just another day, it's just another piece of content. If I go and get a good day, great. If I have a bad day, tomorrow's a new day.
Yeah, you know what, that's such a great analogy, and that's something that I'm still working through, but the way that you've kind of framed it there really does help. And the thing is, I do tell myself this, but hearing you reframe it and say that's the whole reason why I film 30 pieces of content in a day, because there's not all this pressure just on that one piece of content to deliver, which I am guilty of, because sometimes I only have time to film one piece of content in a week. But again, but if I do reframe my attitude and think, okay, how can I better utilize my time to make sure that I can be making these pieces of content quicker? Or if I can't, now I need to be aware of the fact that I need to emotionally detach myself from what's going on.
And also, the other thing then you've got is, you've got the quality of people think about quality versus quantity of the content, but people don't think about the quality versus quantity of the viewership. So, for example, you could get 100,000 people that see a video and people just go, oh, that's nice, thank you very much. That's attention, which is great. You know, we want attention, but retention is much more important than attention. Like, we can get attention's easy. I can put $5 into a post if I want to and go and get 1,000 people to see something. That's a lot of people. They don't care. They're not signing up for anything. Whereas you never know when you put a post out, even if you get three people to see something, You don't know who those three people are. So imagine if you put a piece of content out, your brain is saying, oh, I got the dreaded 200 on TikTok. Mm-hmm. That 200 mark where you just go, God, what did I do wrong? But you don't know that one of those people in that 200 might have a festival that they're looking for an artist, or they're a band who are looking for a bass player for a tour, or they're a TV program that's just spotted you and asked you, I need you to come and do some work. Like, you just don't know the quality of people. So we never think about that. All we're thinking of is the big max number of it's always a million as well. I need a million. Yeah. I want a million views and I want a million this, and not thinking of, well, what does that mean? What is a million? A million is more chances that someone good's going to see you. But the sliding doors moment is when somebody sees you and something happens. Like for me, my entire career, everything, I know where the sliding doors moment was, which was I was down, really down, because my record label dropped us off the label. I was like, well, I don't know what to do. And I was sat in my bedroom. Well, I'd moved out, but I was like 18 years old. I went back to my parents. I was just sat there, I brought my bass, I was playing. And my mum walked in with a local newspaper, which was called the Evening Post. And it said, look, I found this article and it's from the Prince's Trust. And they're going to do this free workshop for a week. And they're looking for musicians. You should apply for it. And I was like, I looked at her. This was so arrogant, by the way, horrible. I looked at her and I was just like, I've just been dropped from a major record label. Why am I going to go to a Prince's Trust free event? Mm. And she said, my mum's so lovely. She just went, well, I'll just leave it here anyway.
No.
And she just left it on the table. And I just looked at it and I was like, whatever. And I just carried on playing. And I was playing. And for some reason, I was playing and I was just looking at the paper. And something in my brain just kind of went, well, what else are you going to do? Mm. You might as well. And so I was like, and something in me just went, fine. Give me a ring. So I rung up and I was like, look, have you got any spaces for bass players? Obviously they have, because no one's playing bass.
No.
And they went, yeah, we have. We've got some slots for bass player. Do you want to come? It was in Cardiff, which was like, you know, and I was like, fine, I'll turn up. I turned up to this event, which was a week. I had the time of my life, by the way. It was brilliant. But I met this guy called Ewan Smith. And Ewan Smith walked in, big hair, amazing guitarist. And I just got on with him so well. And from there, I kept in touch with him. And I was going to go to a different music college. And he said, there's a new one opening up. You need to go to this music college because it's going to be great. And I'm going to be teaching there. And I said, great. I went on the first day. I met a guy called Bruce, who became my mentor and business partner for BIM. And like everything from BIM through to, you know, what I'm doing now, through to living in Nashville, everything stemmed from that one moment of my mum walking in with the newspaper and me just going, I'll give it a go.
Yeah.
If I hadn't have done that, I'd probably still live in Swansea. I'd probably be working in a factory. Like, who knows what I'd be doing? And so when it comes to social media, you just don't know. If you don't put that piece of content out, just because it might have been seen by 200 people, you just don't know that somebody in there isn't that sliding doors moment that is going to not only open up that opportunity, but is going to open up 100 opportunities, which are just going to be a domino effect until all of a sudden you're playing Wembley Stadium thinking to yourself, how did this happen? Mm. And you trace it back and go, oh, I did that piece of social media content that person messaged me, and it just keeps going. And we have to think about, you just never know.
Yeah. And in that moment as well, when you decided to do what was on that newspaper, that was you actively fighting your ego, because you'd just come from being signed at 18 and then in a sense had to humble yourself and say, no, let me say yes to this opportunity, which is something really difficult to do. And that goes back to, posting on social media is something you kind of always have to keep your ego in check, because as we said, you'll post a TikTok video that will get 2.5 million views and then that's it then. And then if you didn't have your ego in check, that'd be something that would completely destroy you. So
yeah, 100%. And so I think we have to think about social media as a tool, and people get caught up in, I get loads of stuff on my YouTube which is like, TikTok's a Chinese conspiracy something, and I'm just like, yeah, I don't doubt there's probably lots of politics, I'm not really good at that stuff, but at the same point, it does mean I can get in touch with musicians, which is very helpful to me. So from a selfish point of view, it works for me. And one day it won't. And one day I'll go somewhere else. And, you know, I try not to think about the, you know, the technicalities. I try and think about, you know, how can you and I be doing this now? It's because of social media.
Completely. So at what point did you set up the DK Music Business Academy? When did that come into the picture?
It's same thing as you with lockdown. So after I sold the music college, I had a management company. I was doing a lot of playing because when I sold the music college, all my friends worked in the music college. So and I was like, what am I going to do for the rest of my life? I mean, luckily I knew that I didn't have money. I knew that I was going to sell my shares in the company, but I was like, what am I going to do? And so I remember looking across the room, seeing my black P bass and going, I just need to get out of the house. I need to play. That was like my safety blanket was I need to play bass. And so I phoned up some friends and I was like, I want to play bass. I want to get out of the house. I don't want to be talking to financial people and accountants and all that sort of stuff. I was like, I just want to play. So we set up a bit of a band. I started, you know, getting offered to do some other gigs. And then I set up a management company and it was great. I got to play bass. And then it was like all fine until COVID happened. And all of a sudden I had 120 musicians that were out working on a weekly basis. I had 15 full-time members of staff, and I'd never seen anything like it.
Wow.
And it just everything stopped, and we were, you know, we were in the same boat. We were all stuck in a house. You know, we're all there being like, how long is this going to take? And people are asking me questions and go, what happens next? And I'm like, I don't know. Like, this is not something that I can go back and just go, well, the last time this happened, like, this is like new. And so, you know, we were losing people, musicians were quitting, musicians were saying, I have to move back home. You know, we had musicians that were living in like Brighton. They were like, look, my parents live in Birmingham. I have to move home. So I'm out. We were losing musicians. I was losing members of staff because we didn't have any money. It was horrible. And at the time, my wife worked in TV. She's a TV producer. And she was like, I remember saying to her, I've seen this movie before in the way, not COVID, but in the way that everyone was basically down Brighton Beach in Brighton. Everyone was like getting furlough money and down Brighton Beach. And I was like, we have to build something because this is something that is going to change our course. And so we were talking about different ideas of how we could both use our skill set, you know, education and what we had versus her ability to be able to produce better content and other things. And this idea that, and it was actually Scott's Bass Lessons was the kind of inspiration. I love Scott. Scott is an absolute legend. He is one of the nicest
guys.
He's such a nice guy, such an inspirational player. I actually, you know, Scott's Bass Lessons, I became a member of during lockdown because I was like, now's the time I can play some awesome bass.
Yeah.
So I just, you know, I got my membership to Scott's Bass Lessons, and I used to sit, and I used to just, like, anytime I wanted to switch off and just sit there and play for half an hour and just start watching and learning and playing. I loved it. And I was like, there's just not this for music business. There isn't this idea where, you know, I used to say when I was a kid, I was like, from an artist, you know, band point of view, I was like, I will do whatever it takes. The problem is, I don't know what that means. So you have to kind of tell me and then I'll do it. But if you don't tell me, I don't know what to do. So I will do whatever it takes, but please tell me. Labels don't tell you, managers don't tell you, the industry doesn't tell you. So I'm like, can someone just shine a light on what I need to do? Because I feel like I'm in the dark. And that was what, you know, what BIM always was. And that's what, you know, that's what DKMBA became. And it started off as just a fun, let's just do a live session. You know, we'll just have a little membership and do a live session. And then it was like, why don't we make some courses? And I never wanted to do the whole, let's sell a course for £1,000. Cause I like, I just feel kind of uncomfortable. And so it started off with just, why don't we just make some courses and have a membership and have somewhere we can communicate and chat with people. And it was, that's always, you know, that's always been the most fun thing, you know, sitting down with a musician and going, what's the plan? Like, I love making plans. I'm like, what's the plan? How are we going to do it? And it just started like that, and it kept growing. And then it got to the point where, you know, in my head, I was like, maybe we'll have like 100 members and we'll just like, we'll have these like chats and live sessions. And I think there was just a lot of need for it. And we got to, I think we got to 1,000 members within the first 3 months or something. And I was like, oh, we're really onto something. I didn't think it would be that, wow, that needed. And then it just kept growing. And, you know, and I think the other thing is, having come from the education of a college education background of building curriculums, you're always under this problem, which is you make the curriculum about 6 months, 9 months before you start the year, and then all of a sudden you've got 12 months of teaching it. Social media is changing on a Tuesday.
I'm like, yeah, so, literally.
So I'm like, yeah, how can you possibly stay up to date? It's, you know, Berklee College of Music or any of these colleges, it's not their fault. It's like, well, the curriculum's in a book, like, you know, it's there. So you can say what's in a record deal, great. But when it comes to strategies of what you're going to do to build an audience and monetize, that literally is changing. Like the advice I give 6 months ago, I was literally on a call yesterday with an artist and he was like, I thought you said, and I'm like, yeah, but that was February. Like, this is June. So he's like, oh, okay. So I'm like, The bit now is, I love the fact that we can change our kind of strategies on the go. You know, we could be like, that was yesterday. Yeah. Today's different. And now we have an opportunity to be ahead of the game. And I feel it very lucky that you know, we now work with some really big labels. And so I get to see it from the coalface and from, you know, from, I feel like I've always been, you know, I'm always the most tuned into the artist who is getting 200 followers, that has got good music, that just goes, hang on, I've got the good music. How do I actually, what do I do with this? That to me is I'm more attuned to than, you know, than the label who's just plowed $500,000 into a radio tour and just goes, look, we've got a load of money and we're putting you on tour with a massive artist. Cause I'm like, well, I feel like you're kind of halfway there. But what happens when you're sat in your room going, I've got this great music, but no one's listening. How do I make that happen? And now I feel like I can kind of hopefully merge the two and say, look, we're able to work with these artists on the ground and I can see what's working. And hopefully I can feed that back in a kind of real time, in a real time way of just saying, oh guys, this just worked. Everybody jump on it. Like quick, like do it. And we've now got members that come through who are like, oh, I just did this thing and this worked. And it's like, great, everyone jump on it. And it becomes this community of like, we're all in this together, which is what the music industry should be. Because, you know, I'm absolutely not against labels, but at the same point, you have to take them for what they are, labels. They are, you know, they are banks and they have high expectations of certain things. And so as much as I'm not against the labels, you know, the community should be always, what are the artists saying? What are the artists doing? How can the artists help each other? How can we as a community of artists and musicians make sure that we, the artists and musicians, not that I am one, but drive forward to help? Because if we can do that, we don't need anyone else, because now it's all about control. But control only happens when you understand the game, if that makes sense. If you understand the game, you have the control. If you don't understand the game, you don't have control. So if we understand the game, we have the control. The more we know, the more control. The more control, the better for everybody. So, and you know, and a big thing here is people just say, oh, it's really oversaturated. And I think that's true. But at the same point, I got signed in like the late 90s. Like, it was still oversaturated. And I lived in Swansea. How am I going to go and get someone from EMI in London to hear a three-piece, four-piece band in Swansea? It's like, that's not going to work. But
yeah,
but it's always been oversaturated. Now you just see it. And so now it's a case of all you've got to do is be better. So what does that mean? What does that look like? How do you become better? Like, when you just said that you started playing in lockdown, I was like, that's amazing. That's like months. That's like 24 to 36 months. That's insane. You're playing for that short amount of time. That's crazy. I thought you'd been playing for like 10 years. But like,
no,
that's so cool. You know, but if the more you know the game, the more you understand what you're doing, the easier it is for you to go, oh, I can do this. The reason why you cut through the noise is because you played a good game. And playing a game also means learning to play. You know, it means learning to play. It means what you play. It means being consistent. It means being likable. All of the things is more than just, you know, oh, I can go and play a Rush song, which is quite complicated. Oh, I've just learned a Dream Theater song. That's really complicated. Oh, I can play Snarky Puppy. That's complicated. Good. But show me. And make sure you're consistent and do the rest of it as well. Because if you can't, if you can't show people, if you can't become employable, then it's very hard to be employed.
Yeah, completely. So comparing being the co-founder of BIM and that whole process to the process of developing DKMBA, what was the difference like for you? Did you have to deploy a whole new load of skill set? Was it completely new? Comparing the two, what would you...
It's a really good question. I mean, BIM was such an unbelievably... I think the thing with BIM is I never... I mean, I loved my time at BIM. I absolutely loved it. I think there's this idea that I left BIM and I hate BIM. I don't hate BIM. I'm so proud of what we achieved. I never expected it to become what it did. And I think the reason why BIM was so successful was because, especially for the first 3 years, you know, especially, not that we did, not this didn't happen after, but the first 3 years, you know, I would have died for every single student there. It was like, it was a mission. It was like, we care more than anything. Like, I care for your career as much as you care for your career. And if it means I have to stay late, I'll stay late. If I have to get up early, I get up early, because we're all in this together. And I think that's why we achieved something that probably most colleges haven't, is because at that moment, it was just the amount of passion for doing something. And I think at the end, for me personally, it just became harder because there was so much politics and there were so many things in there. And you know, you end up, you know, all of a sudden you're like, I'm Damien from Swansea. And all of a sudden I've got this huge college and people are phoning up for interviews and other things. And you're like, probably goes to your head a little bit and you start thinking, this is cool. But at the same point, I'm not doing the things that I love to do. I'm just now business owner. And I think, but it was incredible time. It was amazing. I think DKMBA was just different. It was a necessity thing. We just started building something. It was just like, in the same way as you bought a bass and you went, oh, that's a good idea. I'll play some bass. And then like within a certain amount of time, you were like, oh, this is the thing. This is the thing. I love this.
This is it. Yeah.
And I think DKMBA was that. It started off as just like a bunch of friends and musicians and it just all of a sudden grew. And now I'm like, how can I improve musicians' lives? How can I help? You know, we've just started a new podcast for artists. Cause I feel like when I'm doing podcasts on the whole, I always have these, you know, when I'm thinking of questions, I'm listening to the podcast. I'm always just like, I want to know how you think. Like, I want to get to the bottom of, you know, if you're a manager, I don't just want to get that question of like, you know, the surface level. How did you get into management? I'm like, no. How are these people going to get managed by you? How are you going to find out about these people? Because that's what they need to know. They need to know how you lift this curtain, because we're all in the dark. So let's figure out shining the light. And so then how does the podcast work? How can I bring more people in? You know, I looked at Scott's bass lessons and, you know, I'm like, I'm sat there watching a lesson with people that when I was like 16 years old, I idolized. And now I'm watching them teach me bass, like Billy Sheehan or Nathan East. And I'm like, this is amazing. And I'm like, how can I do the same thing? How can I go and figure out someone from the industry who's going to come in and go, psst, industry secret, by the way, here's a technique that you can use. I'm like, let's figure this out. Because it's there. Like, you know, labels, now that I work with more labels than ever before, I'm like, oh, I see stuff all of the time. And I'm like, I wish I'd known. Like, could someone not have just told me this like 10, 15, 20 years ago? It makes so much of an easier life, but nobody tells you. So I'm like, I'm going to tell you. I'll figure it out. I'll get in. I'll find the secrets. I'll kind of tell you. Because it shouldn't be secrets. It should just be, look, if you're good, if you work hard, if you understand the game and here's the rules, and then you can, you know, you might not be the next Ed Sheeran or Lewis Capaldi, but at the same point, there's no reason why you can't make a really good living and have an amazing bunch of opportunities from music, writing, playing. There's so many ways to do it now. It's just understanding it.
No. Oh, you know what? I do have to say that it is incredibly inspiring that literally just in your lifetime, you are still very young, that you've been able to execute such things like BIM and DKMBA is... I can't say how inspiring it is to me, because I'd love to be in a position in future to, you know, have achieved half of the things that you've achieved, and you clearly are.
I do appreciate that. I really appreciate it. I think, you know, it all comes from for me, I think, just wanting to understand and learn, and then just go, let's, you know, I think the big thing here is, when you play bass, when someone's playing guitar, when someone's writing songs, I think sometimes we lose sight of the fact of this should be about us enjoying the journey of it. Like the and saying, well, you know, what if I do go and do that gig? Or what happens if we do start something together? And I guess is that the power of saying yes. But at the same point, you just never know. I mean, I am not out of the ordinary. I am an absolutely normal human being that comes from Wales and Swansea. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I just feel like I'm halfway through. I'm like, I've got loads of time, but I feel like I think there's still luck that's involved, but you've got to put yourself in the lucky positions. Yeah. I think, you know, if there's one thing I can do, it's work hard. I feel like that's something I feel like, I try and understand, but I feel like the good thing now is with all of the stuff that's out there is if you look at it in a positive way, which is, yes, I guess there's a lot of people doing something, but all you've got to do is figure out what makes you unique, different, and how you're going to get in front of people and how you're going to stick with it. And all of those things that you hear, those horribly influential TikTokers being like, you got to stick with it. And you're like, well, it's true though. You do have to kind of, but you have to enjoy it. If you don't enjoy, so I always said the day that I used to play bass 8 hours a day, the day that I don't want to play anymore, I'll put the bass down and I won't play. And that day came. And then one day I picked it back up. And the last thing you want to be doing is doing something where you don't enjoy it. You've got to have the passion, because otherwise it's difficult to do.
Yeah, you know, I completely agree. So before I let you go, I don't know if you've seen the questions, but my ending question is the same for every guest. This might be a little bit of a surprise one if you haven't seen them. I try to tie it to the title of my podcast. So if you had to choose a song that was essentially your soundtrack to success, so a song that you feel represents you or your journey so far, what song would you pick? I know it's quite an impossible question, because loads of songs in the world.
It's a great song. So a song that represents...
you or the journey that you've been on so far in your music career. It could be a song from when you were 18 that you, or your, the first song you ever learnt on bass. I don't know, I'm just throwing stuff out here.
Okay. Well, the first song, not this would be, the first song I ever learned to play was Bon Jovi, You Give Love a Bad Name. That was the first song I ever learned to play.
Nice.
The song that changed my life was Enter Sandman by Metallica, because I was in a pool hall and I wasn't really into music, but myself and the guy who had the guitar, we were just watching this big like screen back in the day when MTV played songs. And Enter Sandman came on, and both of us were just looking at the screen just wide eyed and like looking at each other and be like, that, we want to do that. It's amazing. That same guy handed me a CD one day, and it was Rage Against the Machine, first album. And it had the Burning Monk on it. He just handed it to me. And he said, look at this. And it was like, I looked at the cover and I was like, whoa. And he put the first track on, which was Bomb Track. And I was like, I'd never heard anything like it. The Timmy C on bass, I was like, it just absolutely blew me away. The whole thing was amazing. And so I would say if I could choose a song that I would like to represent, it would probably be something like Bulls on Parade by Rage Against the Machine. Because I just think the energy of like, attacking, it just attacks the song straight away. Bam, 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 bam. And I'm like, oh, instantly I'm just like, let's do this, we can do this. It feels like I'm in Rocky.
Yeah, no, I love that. That is a great answer. Well, thank you so much, Damien, for taking the time to speak to me today. Honestly, I've really enjoyed it, and I really appreciate you being here and talking and sharing all your knowledge.
I really appreciate you too, and you blow me away by how long you've been playing for. Like, that's amazing. I genuinely enjoy when your videos pop up. I'm like,
win.
It is a win. That's what social media should be. It shouldn't be an overthink. It should be just, you know, 20, 30 seconds of my day where I'm just like, eh, that's good. And then, you know, and I'll see you tomorrow. That's all it is. And I appreciate that.